Thank you.
Yeah.
It's funny. Getting ready, I feel like I'm... Caradwin, good to see you. I feel like I'm... I feel like all of you are watching me make my bed in the morning. Like, hospital corners. I never had so many people watching me make my bed. So, now here's our friends. Hello. Say hello. Hello, Three Poisons. Glad you could make it. Wouldn't know what to do without you. Gee, what would I think? It's so attractive, isn't it? Yeah. They can be really attractive. That's part of the problem. Is they each have their own little seductive mechanisms. They know us well. I had this funny thing happen, I guess yesterday. I couldn't find these glasses, so I had bought a new pair of glasses. I bought these glasses, and then I put these glasses on, and I thought, oh my God, it's the wrong prescription. Everything is so blurry. It's horrible. What's going on here? I kept staring at them as if they could speak, you know. Tell me, what's wrong with you? Right? I'm projecting onto the glasses. Something wrong with you. Then I looked and I saw, oh, I think there's something on them. And there were these protective plastic. So, you never know what it is that's blurring your vision. It's often fairly invisible to you. So that's the Dharma talk. Thank you very much. You think I'm kidding.
It's a pretty good metaphor, though.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Right? I was thinking the other thing is that, you know, when you sit with your eyes just gazing softly, and everyone walks by. Sashin, you really spend a lot of time looking at people's feet. And it's amazing, but everyone has different feet. You wouldn't think that, you know, we're all the same species, but it's amazing how many different feet walk this path. And this path supports every single one of us. Isn't that great to know? No matter how many people are walking it. And I got to tell you, some of you got some really weird feet. And I can say that because my feet are so... No. Como se dice? Shirley, you know what my feet are. They're deformed. Yeah. So, they're, you know, because I have this, you know, problem. Yeah, my feet are really quite, you know, weird looking. But you guys make me feel good.
And what poison is that?
That's the orthopedic poison. So, you notice how light the air feels today? Practice is so wonderful. So we've been, I mean, we're laughing, but we've been making a pretty sober and a kind of serious study of the three poisons. And, you know, which are the underlying fundamental causes for human suffering. And we've been studying their antidotes as well. And this is all from a Buddhist perspective. I'm sure there are other ways of looking at this, but, you know, this is rooted in the Buddha Dharma. And my hope is that, you know, becoming aware of their causes and their antidotes will give us a kind of insight so that the next time one of these poisons or delusions starts to grab us, we can catch it pretty quickly. And, you know, catch and release. We can actually catch it because we're caught by it. But then, you know, these antidotes that I've been talking about are a way for it to, you know, to release it quickly, so it doesn't grab and hold onto us and control us, not just for a second or a minute, but you know, for a lifetime. And I think that, you know, with understanding and with practice, and I can't emphasize the practice of these antidotes enough to you. You know, Dogen, in talking about Zazen, said, if it's not practiced, it's not realized. And those of you who've been practicing for a while know that if it's practiced, it is realized. It will be realized. Because the realization is right in the practice itself. And so the, you know, we say the antidote is the thing that I'm doing, but it's the practice of the thing that I'm doing that just starts to become an automatic way for us to deal with our own suffering and for the suffering of the people around us. And I don't think that we should underestimate our ability to transform these poisons by applying an antidote. We may feel that it won't work, but if we apply it, if we practice it, it will work. It does work. And we should know that. But the practice is essential. So when you find yourself feeling that craving or that yearning, that greed, the superabundant attachment, just remember generosity, gratitude, contentment with what we actually have. I mean, I don't know all of you in depth and personally. Our lives are pretty amazing, I think. We have so much to be grateful for. We can never be grateful enough, in my view, just to be alive. So to practice gratitude, to practice generosity, will help when that craving and that greed and that grasping, you know, gets a hold of you. When ill will or hatred or, you know, most of us don't hate actively, but we do have ill will. You know, we project it out into the world. It's like looking at my glasses and saying, God, there's something wrong with them. When we feel that ill will and we begin to practice metta, loving kindness meditation, it's really amazing. And so the more we're just used to it, almost like an automatic response. You know, you see a stop sign. Maybe that's a good metaphor, actually. As soon as you notice that ill will, that's a stop sign. Turn to metta. Just catch it. Bring that awareness. You know, it's not automatic like that. It actually takes bringing your consciousness with you. I'm choosing. I'm not going that way. I'm going this way. It's very important. I think that we might agree that when any of these three poisons, you know, greed, hatred, or ignorance, or delusion, drive our lives, then we live similar to a way that Hanshan, who was a legendary hermit poet in China in roughly 8th, 9th century, and he wrote this poem that I think is pretty relevant to it. Hanshan is, Kastan Hashi and I are now translating all of his extant poems. There were about 315 of them. There were 307, and then Kaz found 8 more that nobody else is. So I said, why don't we just publish the 8? We've already translated 300, so it's done. And some of you know, but I'm going to China next Monday, a week from tomorrow. And one of the places we're going is to the cave where Hanshan wrote his poems. And he wrote all 600 poems on the walls of the cave. So we'll be practicing in Hanshan's cave, which is really, really quite great. And then also we'll go to Tiantong, where Dogen's teacher Ru Jing was, and where Dogen studied with Ru Jing, and we'll practice in Ru Jing's monastery, which is pretty, you know, it's pretty nice. Anyway, so this is Hanshan's poem. Hanshan means cold mountain, by the way, and that's where he lived. He lived on Hanshan. Han is cold, Shan is mountain, and that was also his, as was typical of the time, the place he lived and his mind were called the same thing. So there was no separation of who he was, where he was, how he was. So Hanshan, cold mountain. And in the literary vernacular of the time, the dusty world, or the world of dust, is sort of the ordinary world driven by the three poisons. So Han Shan wrote, "Humans live in blinding dust, like insects in a bowl. All day we go around and around, and we never get out of the bowl. Even a sorcerer can't measure the endless delusion. Time flows by like water. In an instant, you are old." And that's how most of us live. But there was a wonderful American poet, David Budbill. He just died, I think, in January, in his mid-70s. He had a disease and it took him. And he knew this poem of Han Shan's, and so he wrote a responding poem for Han Shan. And David wrote, "Han Shan, that great and crazy, wonder-filled Chinese poet of 1,000 years ago said, 'We're just like bugs in a bowl, all day going around, never leaving their bowl.' I say, 'That's right. Every day climbing up the steep sides, sliding back down. Over and over again, the round, around, up and back down. Sit in the bottom of the bowl, head in your hands, cry, moan, feel sorry for yourself, or look around, see your fellow bugs, walk around, say, hey, how you doing? Say, nice bowl." So the question is, I love that bowl. You know, nice bowl. But what do you think it takes to say, "Hey, how you doing?" Say, "Nice bowl." What does it take?
Generosity.
Yeah, generosity, yeah.
Acceptance
of the situation. I mean, it's pretty good, don't you think? Right? Yeah, right. He says, yeah, that's right. That's what we do. We slide up, we go down, we go up, we go down. But hey, how are you anyway? That's a pretty good bowl. There's a kind of great wisdom in David's poem that I really love. So today, you know, I want to get down to the root of it, the root of it all. I want to take a kind of brief look at the third of the three poisons, which is really the one that sets the other two in motion and keeps the whole wheel of samsara and suffering spinning and spinning and spinning. And that's ignorance, or sometimes it's called delusion. So greed, hatred, and delusion, or greed, hatred, and ignorance, as we say. And in the Mahayana tradition, there is a very important distinction. I mentioned this at our Sunday study group, I think, with Claire, right? There's a very important distinction between ignorance and delusion. They're not the same thing. Ignorance comes from the Sanskrit word avidya, and it means fundamental ignorance, ignorance at the root, or not knowing reality. Ignorance at the root means not knowing reality. So being unaware of reality, or ignorance of the basic, quite specifically in Buddhism, ignorance of the basic reality of impermanence and interdependence or no self. Basic not understanding that impermanence is a fact of existence, and that what looks like this solid separate self is actually not a solid separate self. So ignorance also, we can say ignorance of our the nature of our true self, or ignorance of our Buddha nature, or ignorance of things as they are. You know, our true self or Buddha nature can be on the other side of it, can be described as kind of interdependent wholeness. So ignorance of that, of what we truly are, you know, this. And then the word delusion in Sanskrit is moha. And moha is a subcategory of avidya. So because of avidya, because of this ignorance of the basic fact of reality, there is moha. And moha is described as delusion or confusion or incorrect beliefs. So you can see if the foundation is not solid, sorry, if you don't have basic reality, it's very easy for the structure to be shaky. It's very easy then for you to have confusion and delusion and all kinds of beliefs that have nothing to do with reality, and then we live based on those, and then, of course, we suffer. So, in Buddhism, the common but confused and incorrect belief is the belief in a permanent separate self. That's really the core of it. If we have a belief, a conviction in a permanent, separate self, like I've been talking about for the last couple of days, that belief in separation, that belief that I am me and only me, apart from everything else, which cannot be verified. But that paves the way for greed and hatred and delusion. Because, well, you can see, right? Once we have that belief in it, it's very easy to separate out into acts of greed or hatred or ill will or, you know, further delusion, etc. Once those poisons grab us, they not only keep us from enjoying and living out our true nature, living out our wholeness, but they create enormous amounts of suffering. And in addition to the things I've been talking about, they can cause a lot of constant existential anxiety, because you're feeling at any moment just this me, this separate me, and everything else might come and hurt me or get me, you know, in some way. So it can create insecurity and feeling of anxiety, feelings of powerlessness, and that feeling of separation and isolation solidifies the delusion that it's us against the world. And it's a deeply held belief. And probably all of you know that when we talk about interdependence, we can sort of get it intellectually, but it's very hard for us to actually know it as ourselves. We still are sort of convinced by what appears to be a purely separate being with purely separate needs and purely separate wants. And, you know, it's still very, very intellectual. But so much suffering comes from a simple but steadfast belief. I mean, it is really amazing. It's just a tiny delusional seed of separation and non-wholeness, which, you know, there isn't no non-wholeness. Otherwise, nothing could exist. But that leads to our cravings, and that leads to, you know, frustration and loneliness and anger and hatred and all of the other delusions and all the ways that we act these out. Whereas when we have some sense of non-separation, some sense of oneness, it can diminish those poisons and the harm that they cause. And when you think about it, a belief, it's such a small thing. Unless it becomes a very big thing. I had a very, telling moment. Many years ago, remember, President Reagan in the United States was shot. And then a friend said to me, "God, isn't that great?" And I thought, why is it great? I mean, the only difference between you and that man is that you disagree with him. You have a different belief system. So why should he be killed? What kind of thinking is that? You know, that's how blind we can become. Just a simple difference is enough to make other wherever we go. So that's cause and effect. Our beliefs are causes that have effects in the world. We really need to look very deeply and carefully what is it that I really think is true, and then understand that our thinking it's true is called thinking. And there may be more to it than we know. And I think we have a responsibility as people who are dedicated to living awarely and compassionately in the world to check our beliefs. Check and see what's really the case.
Do you think that this feeling of separation is a conscious thing?
Say it again.
Do you think this feeling of separation is conscious, or it's a subconscious, or something that's not known?
I think we're taught it. And then also, I think it is, you know, I don't know what the words unconscious and subconscious, I don't really know what those words mean, but I'll say it my own way. I think deep down in there, somewhere, we know that we are existentially alone, right? I live my life, you live your life, I feel my feelings, you feel your feelings. But that doesn't mean that we're not one, but we believe that we are, because that existential aloneness is very convincing. The feeling of that existential aloneness is very, very convincing. It's very hard for us to get past that notion that I'm just me and you're just you, because we feel it. Feelings are, you know, they're really convincing. And so I think it's both conscious and unconscious. And then we get into a culture which talks about, you know, the rugged individualist and, you know, glorifies the individual. And, you know, then you get somebody saying America first, and, you know, you see where it goes, right? You know, it just takes you right to the moon. But, yeah, I think it's both conscious, unconscious. And, you know, remember I was talking about cultural inheritance as well as personal inheritance? It's a cultural inheritance. So that even if we have a slight inkling that we're separate, the culture will say, yeah, that's right. I'm gonna say this in a different way. When I was a boy, I was the object of other people's racism. And fortunately, for some reason, I knew that when they were calling me the names they were calling me, and when they were beating me up for being what they said I was, that they were wrong. That I wasn't those things. I wasn't any of them, in fact. And somehow they didn't beat it out of me. I maintained contact with something that knew that we were not separate. Even though they were beating separation into me. And, you know, and I was quite scared, of course, and I heard. You know. I think we know somewhere. I don't think that's special to me. I think we know somewhere this oneness connection, but it's not nourished. That's part of the problem. It is really not nourished. And it's one of the reasons our practice is so important, is because it nourishes it. So let's get to avidya. Let's get to ignorance. So we know that the antidote for greed is dana, is generosity. And we know, you know, plus a good amount of maybe a little dash of non-attachment and contentment. Right? And we know that the medicine for ill will is loving kindness, is metta. We know that. These are the teachings. So you've been really on top of it. What would be the antidote to ignorance?
Awareness?
Awareness is part of it. So that's a good answer. That's one step. Next. Zazen is the practice of the antidote.
Perception?
Well, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh told me once, perception is delusion.
Right?
Okay, so I won't make this. This is not a multiple choice. It's called amoha, non-delusion. Or it's called prajna, which is correct understanding or wisdom. So, correct understanding or wisdom. So prajna, you know, we say prajna heart sutra. You know, this is the perfection of wisdom. So the antidote to ignorance is actually wisdom. What is wisdom? Correct understanding. It's pretty simple. We don't have to make wisdom into a university. It's seeing clearly and understanding and knowing things exactly as they really are. So this is one way to think about it. It's one of the paramitas. It's one of the six perfections, you know, wisdom, like generosity. And in Buddhism, what we've been discussing, and this is the antidotes, and I really want to tell you this, generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom are essential for liberation from suffering. Mm-hmm. To paraphrase the commercial, you can't go home without them. Take it in. Essential for liberation from suffering. Generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom. Which replaces greed, hatred, and delusion. And this is sewn right into, it's just like all the stitches in Araksus, this is sewn right into the heart of the understanding that Buddhism brings to the world. So I feel very grateful that we have a practice that wants to bring all of this out on the table and put it on the surface so we can see it. And that gives us practices so that we can do it, so that we can actually accomplish this kind of liberation for the sake of all beings in our lives. So let's stay with Prajna a little bit. In the Heart Sutra, which we've been chanting, we say Avalokiteshvara, who's the Bodhisattva of compassion, right? Avalokiteshvara, who helps all to awaken, moves in the deep course of realizing wisdom beyond wisdom, which is Prajna. Okay, wisdom. So compassion moves. Another way to say it, another translation is not just moves in the deep course of realizing, but courses deeply. So the Bodhisattva, the awakening being of compassion, courses deeply in wisdom. Because compassion by itself is not enough, and wisdom by itself is not enough. But because this awakening being is awakening, this awakening being has compassion and wisdom together and sees essentially the fact of things, which is that all five streams of body and mind are without boundary. That's impermanence and no self functioning. Sees the truth of impermanence and no separate permanent self. And because she does move deeply in wisdom with the heart of compassion, she's able to free all from anguish. That's what the sutra says. So it's the combination of those two together that's very, very important for us to understand. It's why we cultivate the heart of compassion and we cultivate the mind of wisdom. And at some point, you will discover that these are actually the same. These are not two separate things. I think I've told you this before, but I once went to my teacher and I said, I have a suspicion, is Guanyin, is Kanon, the Bodhisattva of compassion, no different than Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom? And he said, let me answer it this way. Manjushri has the sword of wisdom. And it has two edges. And one edge gives life, and the other edge takes life away. And when you know the difference, that is compassion. Mm-hmm. That was really an amazing teaching, mm-hmm. to realize that they're the same mind, really. And they function differently. Like we say, each thing has its own virtue and relates to everything else in function and position. This is compassion and wisdom working together. So the sutra also goes on to say that those who abide in prajna, in the realization of wisdom beyond wisdom, right, live with an unhindered mind. Which means that the mind, when we abide in that way, the mind is free from fear, anguish, delusion, confusion, contusion, and all the other shuns that you could come up with. So yesterday, because I don't want this to stay in the realm of bodhisattvas flying around somewhere, since we are kanon, we are manjushri, waking up to ourselves. I talked a little about Martin Luther King and the others who practiced the reality of non-separation against enormous odds and were able to accomplish a lot, because reality is a powerful foundation. It's a very powerful foundation. And in Zen practice, Dogen teaches that the wholehearted practice itself, the wholehearted practice of Zazen itself, rather, is the practice realization. So when you said Zazen, I didn't want to answer it yet, because I knew I wanted to get back to this. That wholehearted practice of Zazen is the practice of reality itself. That's what Dogen is teaching. And that there's no gap between practice and realization. There's no gap between practice and prajna. Dogen says there's no gap between practice and nirvana. That when you fully and completely give yourself to your zazen, that is practice realization, and it's just one thing. And everything is included in it, including your aspiration and your practice and your realization and full understanding. So Dogen is saying, you can do it. It's right there. And this is what he calls the art of Zazen. So, and he's quite clear. He says this phrase over and again. Practice with our whole body and mind. Right? Whole body and mind. It doesn't mean 99%. Because we know how strong delusion is. Whole body and mind. Everything. Holding nothing back. 100%. Complete. And when we do practice in that way, whether we're taking our step in Kinhin, you know, that fully integrated step that I talked about, or whether we're eating our food and really eating our food, or whether we're washing our bowls in our yogi and really doing it, when we give ourselves with whole body and mind, no matter what the activity is, it's Zazen mind, then in that moment we become one with ourselves. Our true self is being manifested, is being expressed through the activity. And oneness is there, wholeness is there, prajna is there, Buddha is there, everybody's at the party. And I'm willing to bet that at some point in your life, at one time or another, you have experienced that. I'm willing to bet that that's true. Probably by accident. But we don't have to do it by accident. We actually have a practice that's rooted in this. And it's good for us to know that that's the case. And when we slip out of it and the three poisons do manage to grab us again, I found this wonderful quote from Tendo Nyojo, from Rujin, from Dogen's teacher. Rujin said to Dogen, just practiced wholeheartedly and the negative effects of karma, including the three poisons, will be turned around. That's fantastic. That's really fantastic. So wholehearted practice is the ultimate antidote that brings generosity and loving kindness and non-delusion, right, into the full being, and it brings it into the world. And it's why it's so important that as you're practicing and you're holding back and you're pushing back and you don't want to and you're getting deluded and you're getting confused, you just give yourself away. There's nothing will be gained by all that resistance. You have to just die to the resistance. And it's one of the reasons that, you know, a sufficient amount of Zazen, where you're fighting, and all of a sudden there's just nothing left to fight with. Good sign. Then you can crack through and know that what I'm saying to you, and that, you know, of course, that what our wonderful teachers have taught is actually not fantasy. It's really the case. I want to sort of bring the talks to a close by saying that there really isn't very much more I can tell you about wisdom, about the antidote to ignorance. It would just be talk. I can, you know, I know all the words. I read the dictionary. You know. I can tell you all kinds of fancy stuff about it, except to say that our practice does help to cultivate it in our lives, and when we do, we have a true medicine for the suffering in this world. And even if just you take the medicine, because of the way you will live through in the world, that medicine will reach the world. And it's very important for us to know that we can do that. And as far as I'm concerned, to give our lives to it because of the nightmare, you know, that we're seeing and so much suffering in it. There's in Zen literature, there's something called the Platform Sutra, which is quite something. Have any of you studied or read the Platform Sutra? Yeah, it's quite great, isn't it, Bob? Amazing, amazing thing. And it tells what's probably an apocryphal story about the Zen sixth ancestor named Hui Neng, and how he received a Dharma transmission from the Zen's fifth ancestor, Hongren. And what happened was that Hongren put a sort of challenge out at the monastery, and he said to his students, I'd like you all to write a short poem on the essence of mind. And then whoever's poem shows the most mature understanding You will become my Dharma heir. Not bad, eh? So, there was a monk named Shenxiu there. And if you were to take a vote, everybody would have said, yes, Shenxiu will get it. He's got it. He's the guy, you know. And so Shenxiu was a really great student. You know, he seemed really the most likely guy to do it. And so in response to Hungren's challenge, in the middle of the night, it's told that Shenxiu went and he wrote a poem on the wall of the temple, anonymously. He didn't sign it. Very good, student. Guess who, right? So I translated that poem the other day. And here's what Shenxiu wrote. Shenxiu wrote, the body, so Bodhi is enlightenment or awakening. The body is a Bodhi tree. The mind is like a standing mirror. Polish it always to keep it clean. Don't let it gather dust. So that's pretty good. So Huineng, he was working at the temple. And Huineng was illiterate. You know, he couldn't read or write or anything like that. But he heard about this challenge. So he went into the temple and kind of looking at Shenxiu's poem. And another monk came by and he said, could you please tell me what that says? So the monk read Shenxiu's poem to Huineng. And then Huineng said, would you please write? I have a poem I'd like to make up now. Would you please write it next to Shenxiu's poem on the wall? The monk said, yeah, that would be fine. So this is like the first poetry slam. This is early Buddhist poetry slam. So Huineng's poem said, right, okay, so Shenxiu's, the body is a Bodhi tree. The mind is like a standing mirror. Polish it always to keep it clean. Don't let it gather dust. So Huineng said, Bodhi has no trees. The mirror has no stand. Originally, there is not a single thing. Where did you get this dust? It's pretty good, don't you think? So Hungren read the poem and he called Huineng into his inner chamber immediately. And he taught Huineng the Diamond Sutra. He expounded it to him. And when Hungren got to this line, to use the mind, yet be free of any attachment in the mind, Huineng had we're told, had a great awakening. To use the mind, but to be free from any attachment in the mind. You know, that's really clear water. That's water you can swim in. That's water you can drink. To use the mind, but be free of attachment to the mind. So when he heard that, Huineng had a great awakening. And here's what was quoted that Huineng said. He said, how amazing that self-nature, we can say Buddha nature, but how amazing that self-nature is originally pure. How amazing that self-nature is unborn and undying. How amazing that self-nature is inherently complete. How amazing that self-nature neither moves nor stays. How amazing that all dharmas come from this self-nature. And after he said that, Hungren said, here's the robe and here's the bowl. And these were the symbols of the Dharma seal of enlightenment and passing on the lineage to him. And we're told that's how Huineng became Zen's sixth ancestor. And I think that, you know, despite how life can be, how hard life can be, with our ancient twisting karma, born of beginningless greed, hate and delusion. It's amazing what our true nature is. And to touch it. And to practice it. And to however much we can, give it freely to the world. This is a good life. I'll end with this poem. I wrote this poem, I don't know, a year or two ago or something, when I was in my late 60s. And the first line is, sometimes seeing what is not there. So that's, you know, like making up stories, projections, fantasies, transference and delusions. You know. And the second line is, other times not seeing what is. So in other words, getting lost in our story. So in autumn, sometimes seeing what is not there, other times not seeing what is. Our legs become tangled. Our hands can't stop ringing against themselves. Still, we live mid-stagger with pure hearts. Let no one's ignorance fool you. People do not become Buddhas. Buddhas do not become human life. Unborn and undying, like a torn leaf in an autumn shower. When was wholeness ever not whole? So, I apologize because my talk took longer than I hoped it would, but I didn't want to tell you about my glasses. Let's take a few minutes. Just based on all the things that we've been doing and practicing, would anyone like to say anything? How is it with you? Yes, Simon?
This third antidote, you know, like it seems to me the first one, which was generosity, the second one, compassion. Wisdom is a harder one to pin down. Like I find that wisdom is kind of like it seems like two other ones, and kind of like there was some kind of,
you can relate to it.
Yeah, where this one, it kind of makes you wonder kind of like, what is wisdom? Which is where the poem really clear points it out. But yeah. I guess the next thing comes to me is like right action. Is that
Sure. If you have wisdom, right action will be like that.
Right
because you're not clouded.
Right, but it seems like somehow when I think of right action, then all of a sudden wisdom comes along without having to make, you know, try figuring it out.
Yeah, well, you know, this last phrase that you just said, Simone, is very important. You can't, quote, figure out wisdom, right? It is... Anybody else? Yeah, Bob, please.
Generosity is a natural child, as it were, of wisdom and compassion.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it has to occur.
Absolutely. You know, once compassion starts to really possess your being, and, you know, that compassion, and I mean compassion is not a feeling. We associate it with feelings of empathy and sympathy and all that. Compassion is a way of being in the world. And once compassion starts to really possess you, it's because wisdom is already functioning, right? And once that happens, generosity is the natural, just as you say, it's the natural expression. There's no part of you that would hold back or hoard or spare Dharma assets. It just is because you couldn't find a reason to do it, because you're already connected. That's why you're doing it. So of course, you know, there's, I can't remember what it is now, but you know that verse in Buddhist literature, just as a mother who would give her life for her child. That's what we're talking about. Say it again?
In
the Metta Sutta. Right, exactly right. I mean, just that way. It's part of what I'm trying to say to you is that this is us already. And there are methods for us to find out what us already is so that it can be expressed in the world. Because the reason we're in the trouble we're in is because we have no idea what we are. And we just keep buying the wrong romance novels. Yeah, Judith.
I just wonder if you would, I keep going to that 100 Butterflies poem that has resonated throughout this about when I was born, that I was...
Oh, yeah. Let's see.
Say that.
I'm not sure I know it. Let's see.
I was already sick.
Yeah. Well, I don't remember the beginning of it. I have written thousands of poems since then. But let's see. Well, I'll just say something at the beginning. So even at birth, I was parted, not just from my mother, but body from mind from its source. That's why I take up this soft blade of breath, to cut me back into one. So that's not quite the poem, but basically the idea is that even from birth, there's this separation as we come into human form. But the practice brings us back to one. And that's the idea of the poem. I wish I could remember it, because I like that poem. Once Shirley and I were walking, do you remember, in Topanga Canyon? And I said to you, oh, you know, I've got this line in my head that's just, I really says it. I mean, this guy nailed it. I can't remember who wrote this. And Shirley said, what is it? And I told her, she said, oh, you wrote that. I couldn't remember that. Well, you know, that's the way it goes. And I was young then. Now I have no idea. Yes?
Just back to this practice and the compassion and wisdom element. I think that is the action. That the action is this zazen, to help you be in the present, in the here and now.
Right.
And the more you can do that, I think then you become aware. Awareness of self, but then awareness of people, everyone around you.
Right.
And when you develop that, I think that's when you can, the practice of compassion becomes also what you are being.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, here's the way Dogen said it. Zazen is all-inclusive.
Yeah, okay.
Nothing's left out.
Yeah.
Right? Zazen is all-inclusive. So zazen should not be confused with sitting on a pillow and crossing your legs. It's the quality of being as the mind reveals itself to itself through the practice that's described as zazen practice. You know, otherwise we have to sit on the, you know, we can't do anything, right? I'd like to help you, but I'm, you know. And you know, besides, I got 15 minutes left on the meter, so you know, I don't want to give up my spot. You know, it doesn't work that way. It's a natural expression, and I again, if you can remember back at some point, whether you can remember it or not, we knew this. That's what it is. Even at birth, I was parted, not just from my mother, but body from mind, mind from its source. That's why I take up this soft blade of breath, to cut me back into one. Thank you. Now I remember the poem. Even at birth, I was parted. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
For me, the way I've been experiencing it is that just to, through zazen, it's almost like the coming to this awareness, or like panoramic awareness, then metta starts kind of happening. Sometimes when I try to, and it feels forced, it's almost like just coming into a bigger breath, and it starts.
That's right. And there's no reason to force, and force won't work. Just listen to the language. You know, I'm going to force myself to be loving and kind. It's ridiculous. What's the matter with you? You be loving and kind now, or I'll give you one. Yeah,
you sound like somebody I know.
Yeah. I just had this little flash that, you know, we always talk about letting go. And,
right.
And I just realized that's the expression of generosity.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Open your hand. Let it go.
The other thing that's been running through my head throughout these talks is the idea of sympathetic joy.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that was a huge thing.
Yeah.
Because I had a lot of jealousy when I was a child,
uh-huh,
about people getting more than I
right
did,
mm-hmm,
or being better than I was.
Yeah.
And it was really hard for me honestly be happy for somebody else mm-hmm. if they got mm-hmm. some kind of an accolade
yeah.
or something. And I'm seeing that this, you know, that when you have that, when you have compassion, when you, you know, that's part of wisdom, that
mm-hmm.
you can just really go, wow, isn't that great?
Yeah. And it's, you know, you're not alone in it. I mean, you're not the only one who, you know, who has felt that way. Most people at one time or another, or sometimes a lot, you know, feel that way. And it takes a lot of receiving of metta to break up that hurt. And then I can afford to be happy for them because we've received enough of that essential thing that everyone needs, basically. You know? And if we can't get the world to, you know, organize itself so it takes care of it for us, but we can do it. And we can do it. And that's why when you're doing the metta practice, I'm saying do it slowly, do it sincerely. Don't just say the words. Really wish for to be loving. Really want yourself to be kind. Really want yourself to be well or safe. Or, and the other thing is since we're talking about metta practice, is you might notice that you sit down to do metta practice and all of a sudden the first thing you say is, may I be safe. Listen to that. That means that something inside of you is telling you you're not feeling very safe. Suddenly it's jumped the queue. It's gone to the top of the list. Pay attention to that and practice that and let it be first. Don't correct it.
Mm-hmm.
Let your deep being tell you what's on fire.
Mm-hmm.
Trust. Every time you give an act of trust to that deep being that you are helping yourself to come out, you know, fully as you really are and know who you are and trust who you are. And you're sending a message to that deep self that says, I trust you. So let me have it. I'll take good care of it. We need to stop. So thank you all.